3. The nightmare, or at least the worst phases of it, had begun to come to an end, and much more quickly than it had developed. First, there was a jurisdictional dispute among the various police forces, and though John was booked at the state police substation, he was soon taken, still manacled, to his own town, actually a medium-sized city, for arraignment. And his pleasure in going home, or anyway closer than he had been to home all day, was, once he began to recognize landmarks outside the windows of the car, almost immediately soured by the humiliation of returning in handcuffs. Suppose someone he knew saw him. He had watched with scorn the captured criminals who hid their faces from television news cameras as they were herded toward jail, but now was grateful for their example. Could you please handcuff me in front? He asked Brockett. Or to yourself, I think I have a right to cover my face.
I can see why you would be ashamed, Brockett said, ignoring the request.
But things suddenly began to go John's way when they reached City Hall, one wing of which was occupied by police headquarters. Beneath the building was a parking garage for official cars. Trooper Franklin, still at the wheel, drove down the ramp and into the far corner of the underground enclosure. There was no need for John to hide his face. Only some local officers were in attendance. In the elevator, which traveled only one story but so slowly that the trip seemed eternal, under the prevailing conditions, one of the local cops murmured something into Brockett's ear.
"Huh?"
Brockett asked in apparent disbelief, shaking his large head, turning to glance back, raising his brow, at Franklin. He was clutching John's right elbow. John was still handcuffed at the small of his back. Nothing further was said by anyone until the delegation, which attracted stares from a few corridor passers-by, none of them reporters, went inside a large corner office and faced an incongruously frail-looking man wearing a gold-buttoned blue uniform and a white shirt, the collar of which was slightly too large for his neck.
"Hi, John," said he, putting out his hand. "I'm Chief of Police Markovici."
He scowled at Brockett.
"Take those cuffs off."
"Chief, he's our prisoner."
Markovici's scowl grew darker.
"That's going to quickly change, officer. This man should not have been collared in the first place. He's been well vouched for. The lady came in who was a fellow captive. She not only cleared him of any possible suspicion, but she says he's a hero, for God's sake. The fugitive we want has been identified as Richard Harold Marinville. He was just released from Barnes Psychiatric first thing this morning. He's got a sheet it takes all day to read."
Brockett was shaking his big head.
"What about all the so-called eyeballs?"
"I don't know how long you've been in law enforcement," said the chief, "but if it's half as long as me, you know how questionable all witnesses are, I'd say, especially those people who claim to have seen the whole thing, whatever that might be, if only a fender bender."
Brockett shrugged and admitted the truth of that sentiment. He unlocked John's cuffs.
"What were we supposed to do?" he asked the chief. "We got the call."
The chief put his hand out again to John, but spoke to Brockett.
"I'm a good friend of your superintendent. We'll do this informally. I'm going to tell him you and your partner did a fine job."
"Appreciate it. I'm Brockett. My partner's Franklin."
"You owe me one," the chief said amiably, then to John, shaking his somewhat benumbed hand. "We're real sorry about this. The young lady's right down the hall, and they brought the boy in, too. He's settled down now and says you're okay. He got you wrong at first, he says. Also, the fine ladies at your place of business gave you a report that should make you feel good. They think the world of you. Mrs. Markovici, my wife, knows Tess Masterson from the Business Women's Association."
He grasped John's shoulder.
"We're all proud of you, John. You're one of our own. Now, if you don't mind going down the hall and giving my men all the information you can on this Marinville."
He took his hand away.
"You deserve a lot of credit for doing what you did with him. He's got one of the worst records I've ever seen. In and out of one penal facility or another since he was a teenager. Lately he's been working one of those fake deals at Barnes, antisocial behavior due to an explosive personality disorder. They treat them with drugs for a while and let them out as cured. You see what happens? Marinville's a lot worse than when he went in.
In the past, he's assaulted a lot of people and pulled a lot of robberies, usually getting very little money but hurting as many people as he can. But he's never committed a homicide until today. Not for want of trying, though. He's cut people real bad, and once he beat a man with a baseball bat so savagely the victim's brain impaired, he's the kind who should be burned. But no, we'll go all through this again in a few years when they let him go still another time.
Excuse me, Chief, said Trooper Brockett. We're going to need some paper on the transfer.
Markovici said nothing, but with a finger directed the trooper to one of the uniformed men who stood in wait. Brockett spoke at John's side.
No hard feelings. It's the job.
John felt lightheaded. He nodded at the trooper, whom he could see clearly in the physical sense, but who seemed morally a blur.
Now, if you don't mind going down the hall with this officer, Markovici said, pointing at another man in uniform. We can...
My family, John said. Richie was heading for my home. Have you checked on my family?
Let me just get the latest on that, said the chief, reaching for the phone on his desk and stabbing at one of the buttons on its panel.
He was driving a Smithtown police car, John said.
Markovici winced and waved and spoke into the telephone. John had now emerged fully from his momentary stupor and was exercised once more. The chief said rapidly,
Okay, get going. The man is justifiably concerned.
He hung up.
Seems they've been trying to phone for quite a while, but the line's been busy and...
Oh, for Christ's sake! John shouted. What good are you people anyway? You don't send a car there when some maniac is roaming the streets?
Now take it easy, John, Markovici said, waving a pencil. Let me set your mind at rest on one matter. The Smithtown car was found abandoned just off the motorway at the Costerton exit. That's a good 30 miles from here, and there haven't been any reports of car thefts out that way.
The chief smiled.
Anyway, one of our cars is probably at your home by now. You live right near DeForest Park, I understand. Nice area. You people will be okay, I guarantee. How many children do you have?
2.
John said impatiently.
Look, can't I go right there first and see them, then come back here?
We really have to nail this thing down, Chief Markovici said, coming to him and taking his elbow, though with a lighter touch than Brockett's.
If you don't mind, John, I know how bad your day has been, but...
With his free hand, he was signaling to the remaining uniformed officers. These men surrounded John as if he were still a prisoner and inexorably escorted him out the door and along a corridor to a room full of shirt-sleeved men, some uniformed, some not. In a far corner was a partitioned enclosure with a door paned in frosted glass. It was closed and bore no identification. One of his escorts opened the door, and John saw Sharon and Tim for the first time since the episode at the barn. Sharon took him unaware with a cry of delight and a hug that was quite forceful for a woman of her size. She thrust herself at arm's length, holding onto his arms.
It's so great to see you, John. God, it's great!
Then she hugged him again. John lost some of the fear that had obsessed him. These two were also a family of his, and he was deeply moved by Sharon's obviously sincere affection.
I'm glad to see you, Sharon. I feared the worst.
He felt a sudden access of guilt.
I'm sorry I couldn't do better.
What is that supposed to mean?
She asked with mock severity.
Isn't saving our lives enough for you?
I don't know.
He shook his head regretfully. I wish... He continued to touch her, but extended his free right hand to Tim, and the boy rose from his chair and diffidently shook it.
We're all okay now,
Sharon said with a rush of feeling, and she began to sob. John took her in his arms again and kissed her forehead and her cheek just before the tears reached it.
I wish I could say I was as brave as either one of you, he said. I made too many mistakes.
Mr. Felton, a male voice said impatiently. I'm Detective Lang.
He wore a brushy mustache and was seated at the table in the middle of the room. A gold shield hung on a tab from the upper pocket of his tweed sports jacket. A tape recorder sat near his forearm.
Would you like to sit down so we can get the whole story of what happened today?
As John approached the table, Lang stood up and shook his hand.
Look, said John,
I can tell you later. First, I want to check on my wife and children. They've been home all alone all day, and nobody's reached them yet. He had no intention of being further obstructed by the police and started for the door. But behind him, Lang, still standing, said,
John, please, as soon as our car gets to your house and finds everything okay, they'll call in, please. We gotta get this bad guy, and you can really help.
This was the effective note to strike, all right. Now that Sharon was praising him for his non-existent heroism, John believed more than ever that he had been disgustingly inadequate in dealing with Richie. He came back to the table and sat down in the chair that Sharon and Tim had left vacant between them. Sharon was dabbing at her eyes with a tissue. He turned to the boy. You realize now, I guess, that I wasn't Richie's willing partner, but it was dumb of me to break that phone line. I don't know why I did that. I wasn't thinking, and it was stupid. I want you to know I'll pay for the damage. Tim consoled him. You had a lot on your mind at the time. You were under a lot of pressure. Sharon told me what you guys had to go through all day. John asked Sharon, Are you all right? I never got a chance to talk to you alone after we drove out of town. You seemed out of it for a while, but then you really snapped back. Having said as much, he wondered whether he should have. Richie had claimed she was on drugs. It turned out Richie had been right, for the wrong reasons. I've got a condition I take medication for, she smiled brightly through smeared eye makeup. It's not life-threatening, just a pain in the neck, but it kicked up there. You knew from the first what he was, John said. That's what gets me. I didn't have a clue. If I had, just think, maybe I could have saved that poor girl at the gas station. Sharon clasped his hand on the table.
And maybe not, too, John. He had a knife, didn't he?
John shook his lowered head. I guess. I didn't see it, but he never threatened me, never raised a hand against me all day. You saw that. He got this idea I was his friend. I probably could have done a lot more than I did using that against him, but I didn't.
John, said Detective Lang, can we get this going in a more structured way? How did you meet this Maranville in the first place, and then try to remember as many details as you can about everything that happened afterwards?
Lang nodded at Tim and then at Sharon.
And you two can jump in at the right point if you remember something on your own. I got your original statements, but John might mention something that will trigger your own memory, either one of you.
John turned his hand so that he was clasping Sharon's. Christ, how could I know he would go into the taxi office and attack that woman?
How could you know? Sharon asked. Nobody's blaming you, John, so just stop this stuff. Think of what you did for Tim and me.
John, said Lang.
I think you two saved yourselves, John said. In spite of me. That's what I think.
John,
asked the detective, dancing his fingers above the tape recorder buttons. If you would, please. He spoke toward the machine, identifying himself, John, Sharon, and Tim.
Now, John, when did you first encounter Richard Harold Maranville today, and did you know him prior to today?
John stirred in his chair, taking his hand from Sharon's.
There's been enough time now for your people to get to my house and report. Why don't I hear anything?
Lang touched the side of the machine.
I'm sure we will. Any minute now, we're giving it priority. Maybe the officer was delayed getting there.
He gazed blandly at John's stare, but in the next instant turned off the tape recorder and stood up.
Let me go check for you. I know you're concerned.
He carefully closed the glass door on his departure.
The least he can do,
Sharon said indignantly.
You know, you can sue them for false arrest, and I guess he knows that.
It was the state troopers who did it, John said. They had no choice, I suppose. Hell, several people said it was me who committed the crimes. He immediately regretted having made the statement. Tim was probably one of those witnesses. He turned to the lad. I don't mean you. You had good reason. Tim had been looking bored, but he now displayed a grin.
Dumbest thing I did.
was not go out and grab that 12-gauge when you left it on the porch. Then I could have shot Richie when he showed up.
I'll bet you would have done it, too. John was sincere. Living out in the country, you probably know about guns. Beyond that, the boy had proved to be resolute.
There's not a whole lot to know about them, said Tim. You just point them at what you want to hit and blast away.
He lost his grin and said soberly, Well, there is something to learn. My dad taught me what I know, but when he left, he took all his guns with him.
I was wondering, John asked, if maybe I bought a gun and took it out there, you might give me lessons? I'd be willing to pay you.
Tim was enthusiastic.
You don't have to pay me. We could shoot skeet if you'd bring a trap and the clay pigeons. Bird season hasn't opened yet.
John remembered the boy's age.
If it's okay with your mother.
Do you know, said Sharon, he refused to say anything to the police unless they promised not to tell his mother until after she got out of class?
Tim explained.
She's studying accounting at night school. It's tough enough as it is. She's pretty old to have to go back to school. I left a note if I don't get back by the time she comes home.
That will only worry her more, Sharon chided. Can't you see that?
John played the father's mediating role. Maybe he'll get back in time. He smiled at Tim. If not, but Lang returned at that moment. The detective appeared to be smiling under his brushy mustache.
John, you'll be happy to know everybody's okay at your house. The patrolman went to the door and talked to your wife. She and the kids are just fine.
John expelled his breath and squeezed Sharon's hand.
Furthermore, Lang added, briskly reclaiming his chair, it might settle your mind to know we're keeping an unmarked car in the neighborhood until Marinville is apprehended. We don't think he'll head there, but in view of what he told you, we're taking no chances. Now, when we're finished here, we'll give you a lift home.
All right, said John. Let's get this over with as soon as possible. My wife's been alone all day. I haven't even been able to reach her by phone for hours.
You'll be glad to hear somebody's with her there now,
Lang said smugly.
A business associate.
Oh, that's nice. Did you get the name?
Patrolman didn't pass that on,
said Lang, manipulating his machine.
Could it be Tess or Miriam?
Nice of them. Until Chief Markovici's reference to those fine ladies, John had not been aware of their alleged high opinion of him. He had not made a sale in several months, and Miriam, who handled the money, had recently not been eager to advance him more funds. She liked him better than Tess did. Tess was the married partner. Miriam had been divorced many years before. In his opinion, she was more attractive in personality than Tess. John was the only man currently working with Tesmere. He had no special feeling about female as opposed to male bosses, unless it would be that he preferred the former. He had always got on better with his mother than with his father. His father had worked on straight salary for almost 30 years in the payroll department of Bickford Industries before dying suddenly of a heart attack. John had never come close to satisfying him. He had not made the football team in college, nor studied law or medicine, nor even finished school. When he got out of this thing that had consumed his entire day and called into question, in the most basic way, what he was or was not, John determined to get hold of himself and take a hard look at which opportunities might be available to him. He was still young. It was not out of the question that he could go back to school and get whatever credits separated him from a degree. Should not be too many. He had put in 3 years, more or less. Probably have to do it nights, which would take longer than full time, but so what? Meanwhile, maybe the real estate market would pick up again. He could sell houses if buyers were available. He had proved that. He was especially good with the wives. Women, married women anyway, still trusted male salespeople, at least in his experience. What they wanted was someone who would demonstrate an authoritative concern for their interests, which nowadays were not confined to kitchen nursery and home laundry. You could, and in fact certainly should, address them on electrical, heating, and plumbing matters. They would be flattered in any event, but in point of fact, some were more knowledgeable in these areas than their husbands.
Joni was a better driver than he, knew more about automobiles, and all were much less likely to be competitive on such subjects with a male agent, even when, as sometimes happened, they were really better versed than John about heat pumps and bringing the circuits up to code. He now told Detective Lang every detail he could remember of his day with and without Richie. Ironically, he recognized that he had himself performed better in Richie's presence than when he had gone off on his own. The episode at the farm, in which his role had been so sorry before Richie and Sharon appeared, might well not have happened at all had he stayed with the car, in leaving which, abandoning Sharon, he had surrendered to feelings of selfish impatience. He had simply walked away from a situation with which he was fed up. That had been wrong at the time and got no better in retrospect. "I did some foolish things due to panic," he told Lang. "I thought that man was really going to shoot me. That's why I took his gun away from him."
"The shotgun's been recovered," Lang said. "Maranville left it behind when he abandoned the Smithtown cruiser."
Tim spoke up in his eager voice.
"You lucked out. It had a custom stock. It looked like big bucks."
"Yeah," said the detective, winking at Tim. He switched the tape recorder off. "English. Owner valued it at $8,000, though between you and I," he was speaking to John now,
"people sometimes exaggerate for the insurance claim. 8,000?
"Handmade," said Tim. "They can go higher than that."
"Not with me, they don't," said Lang,
switching the machine on again.
"Well, that's one relief, then," said John. "I don't have $8,000.
I haven't got 800. At another time, he might have been embarrassed to make this confession into a tape recorder, but he had the wonderful, warm feeling that he was among friends here. His emotions had gone into a very vulnerable state, no doubt as an after-effect of his ordeal with Richie, which seemed more harrowing in retrospect than when in progress. Perhaps this was the routine interpretation, but he suspected that all clichés having to do with extreme situations are true, and therefore remain eloquent to the participants.
"Yes," said Lang. "Haverford's not going to press charges. He'll get his gun back."
"That's his name?" John asked.
"I didn't even know it. I probably couldn't even find his house again."
He stared at the detective.
"It's crazy. Nothing like this ever happened to me before."
Lang shut the machine off again and said, with understanding,
"John, that's the way it goes with a lot of people we meet in our line of work. We get more solid citizens than bad guys, you know, and thank God, huh? You did just fine. Nobody expects you to be experienced in these things, because how would you be unless you were one of the villains, right?"
he added with obvious pride, "or an officer of the law." Sharon spoke up.
"John pulled us out of some tight corners. I already told you that, but I want to make it extra clear."
John said quickly, "Enough has been made of that. I just hope you can catch Richie soon before he does any more damage to the human race."
"I'd like to see you kill him,"
Sharon cried.
Lang was wry. "You can be assured we'll do everything we can to see his civil rights are protected, even if the lives of police officers are at risk. We'll wrap him in cotton wadding and take him in so he can be sent back to Barnes Psychiatric to be treated at taxpayers' expense till they let him out again."
This kind of cynicism was familiar from television crime shows, and in the past John had become bored with it. Whether or not it was justified, chronic exasperation was simply tiresome, at least in John's existence. He might be changing now, but he did not want to dwell on the matter. He just wanted to go home.
"That's really all I can recall," he told Lang,
nodding at the tape machine.
"If I think of anything else, I can phone you, can't I?"
"Just a couple more things, if you don't mind, John."
Lang proceeded to ask what turned out to be a whole series of further questions, some of which John believed he had already answered. Eventually he had had enough, and he stood up.
"That's it. I'm going home."
"John, you've been very helpful," said Lang. "I'll get a car to give you a ride back, and you too, Sharon."
He rose and smiled down at the boy.
"Tim, Smithtown's sending an officer for you, and your mom will be with him."
I just hope, Tim said disapprovingly, you didn't drag her out of class.
Lang did not respond to this. He said to John,
this is a young fella who's going to do all right in life, wouldn't you say?
John still felt shy with Tim. Maybe we could go into the city and see a ball game sometime, he told the boy. Or whatever you like to do for fun. He felt inept. He had been a boy himself, but at the moment could not remember what he had liked at that age. He was weary now, and it had been so long ago.
Sure,
Tim said, and then he asked if there was time for him to have a look at the radio dispatching room before his mother arrived.
Bye, Tim,
Sharon said gaily as Lang led the boy out.
Keep in touch, huh?
She turned to John.
I don't want you to get in trouble at home, so I won't say the same to you.
She had not had time to refresh the heavy makeup, which by now was the worse for wear, but she had naturally fine brown eyes.
I misjudged you, John said. I want you to know that.
Sharon showed a brief expression of chagrin.
Yeah,
she said.
I came on to you after the car accident. I panicked. I can't get to work without driving, see? And I just had that learner's permit, which isn't legal without a licensed driver in the car. My old man went away, too, like Tim's father. I don't know how to do anything but cocktail waitressing, which doesn't take any talent, at least where I work. Just legs and a butt that doesn't look too bad in the little outfit they give you to wear.
You have any kids?
No, and that's good, the way things have gone so far.
John was suddenly in danger of being overcome with emotion. He already loved her as a loyal comrade in conditions of danger, as cops are said to love their partners. But at the moment, this feeling had become a passion. He adored her, and all the more so for how she looked, with her unkempt red hair and her clothes so touchingly bedraggled. Now that he had received reassuring news about his wife and family, to whom he was connected by duty, he had an impulse to run away with Sharon. Part of this was not desire, but rather a need to atone for what, despite her asseverations to the contrary, he stubbornly considered to be his failures as a man. I really want to keep in touch, he said. Would you mind if I dropped in at the cocktail lounge?
You stay at home, John,
Sharon said, patting his arm maternally.
There's nothing better in all the world.
She snorted.
I'm a real authority on that subject because I haven't got one. I didn't tell you the whole truth. My husband didn't run away. He's in federal prison. He tried to drive across the border with a spare tire full of cocaine.
In his current state, John was not as shocked by the information as he knew Sharon expected him to be. That's your private business, he said. You're a wonderful woman. I wasn't suggesting anything illicit. I'd just like to know from time to time how you're getting along. This was a necessary lie, for actually he was profoundly in love with her at this moment, in a way he suspected she would not find to her liking. Like Richie, what she approved of in him was the husband, the father, the householder, the drone, the non-taker of risks, because he could not jeopardize those and that for which he was responsible. What a convenient moral armor enveloped him. Sharon smiled slowly.
Nah, John, better we shake hands and go our separate ways. I hope we don't even meet at the trial because I'm hoping the cops kill that bastard this time.
John nodded, but he did not want to think about that subject right now. He and she had been comrades. Surely that meant as much to her. If she would admit it, as it did to him. Tim, too, was a part of it. They might all go together to some sporting event, as a team, which would neutralize any hint of impropriety. At this point, Lang returned, without Tim.
Okay, folks, the DA's people will want to talk to you both once Marinville is caught, I know, but let's get you both home safe and sound right now.
Tim's mother get here? John asked.
On her way. Sounds like a nice lady on the phone. Good people out there. My wife and I have been thinking of moving out in that direction. Fresh air, and I believe prices are a lot lower.
John was brought back momentarily to professional normality.
They are, in fact. Home prices run a good 15-20% under what they are in town here. I'm in local real estate.
Lang smiled down from his greater height.
Sure. Think you could find us something I could afford on a cop's income?
I could locate some agent for you in the Smithtown area. We all belong to associations.
Anything around here would do even better, though, Lang said. If the price is right, I'd rather be closer to work if I could, and my wife teaches at Midvale Avenue Elementary.
I'll get on to it as soon as I return to the office, said John. You can never tell. Every so often a bargain comes along. Maybe a fixer-upper?
Worth considering, said Lang. Appreciate it.
He led them along a corridor and down a stairway and through a side door to a green and white police car waiting at the curb. Sharon had the shorter distance to travel, so John climbed in first. Before closing the door, Detective Lang leaned in.
John, don't you worry about Marinville. We'll keep that car in the neighborhood, not right in front of your house, because he might see it and take off, but it'll be close by.
For the first time, John thought of the possibility that the same threat might apply to Sharon. He asked her, don't you want protection too? Think he knows where you live?
Nah.
She waved Lang off, and when he was gone, she whispered into John's ear,
I got a gun at home. I'm just praying he shows up.
The uniformed officer at the wheel turned and spoke through the steel mesh barrier between front and back seats, which distinguished this car from that of the state troopers. He introduced himself as Patrolman Cardone.
Sorry about the screen, he tapped it. It's the only unit free right now. We have had a lot of crime already, and the night is just starting.
His use of the word, and not the darkness through which they walked from lighted city hall to lighted car, was what made John belatedly conscious that evening had come.
What time is it, officer?
8:20.
The car moved away from the curb. Incredulously, John repeated the time.
God, can it be?
He asked Sharon. Did you get your car back?
Cops impounded it for evidence, she said, but they said they'll see I get a lift to work tomorrow.
You're going back to work right away?
The passing street lamps intermittently illuminated her face.
Sure. I'll bet you do, too. I need the money, don't you?
I'm not on a real salary, said John.
I need to make a sale. It's been so tough lately. I'm thinking of moonlighting someplace. I guess they don't have cocktail waiters.
His question was not serious, but she took it as such.
Not at this dump. Maybe a nice bar at some hotel. You wouldn't want to lower yourself, John.
I think you've got a lot of natural wisdom, John said.
He was being serious now and worried that he might sound patronizing, so he added, I mean, I think you know a lot about basic things.
I wish I always did.
That's why I've been so damn successful in life so far, Sharon said. That's why when it comes to men, I didn't pick just one loser, but a whole string of them.
She stared at him.
I don't have anything you could use, John. Take my word for it.
Her attention was diverted by what she saw beyond his shoulder.
Here we are.
She called to Cardone.
Right up there at the fire plug.
She addressed John again gently.
I'm real sorry I don't.
She kissed him quickly on the cheek, opened the door, and hopped out. Watching her through the rear window as the police car pulled away, John recognized the area. There was the donut shop, and on the other side of the street, the taxi office, across the glass door of which stretched the yellow tape that the police post at the scene of a crime. And at the moment, Cardone was driving through the intersection at which Sharon had sideswiped Richie's car, or rather the car that Richie had stolen. He wondered whether the cops knew about that phase of Richie's day. Had the vehicle's owner, too, been murdered?
Surely it was that person's license that Ritchie had displayed to the officer. In any event, Sharon had either just been starting out from home when the accident happened or coming back. She must live in an apartment over one of the neighborhood businesses. She now vanished as the car took a turn, so he could not see just where. He supposed he might encounter her accidentally if he drove this way persistently over the weeks, but why would he do that? He was a married man and a father. He had everything he should want, and undoubtedly she was right about herself. Yet, his heart seemed broken.
"Nice part of town up here," Officer Cardone said genially, as if he sensed that distraction was needed. "You must be right near DeForest."
They were climbing the hill down which John had had the wild ride with Ritchie in the morning.
"Nice up here for kids, I bet. You a family man?"
"Real nice. Primary school's only a few blocks away, but neither of mine is that old yet."
"I got two girls and a boy," said Cardone. "Oldest girl's graduating high school next spring. Wants to go in the Air Force. How about that?"
"There it is," John said. "The white cape on the right." The nearest street lamp was just beyond the edge of John's property. It lighted the front yard up to the junipers that flanked the big, multi-paned front window, which was illuminated now, but as always after dark, Joni had closed the Venetian blind louvers, not wishing to be unwittingly observed from outside. That was a unique practice on this block. You could look right into the ground floor of most of the houses from the street. When she had first done this, John was worried that the neighbors might take offense at the obvious implication. What people thought of him, and his, had always been of concern, but after the day he had put in, he had less regard for the social gauges of others. He who had not long before worn handcuffs as a suspected murderer. Even now, he could not be sure whether he had permanently escaped all legal liability. He must call the only lawyer he knew, Carl Kilmartin, who handled real estate matters for the agency and had acted as his and Joni's attorney when they bought the house. Perhaps Carl could recommend a colleague versed in criminal law and also skilled in dealing with the civil actions that still seemed possible in the matters of the ill woman into whose house he and Ritchie had broken, the gentleman farmer, Haverford, who might, on consultation with his own lawyer, renege on the easy promise to dismiss any claim once the shotgun had been returned. And finally, even Tim, whose mother, needing money, might be less tolerant than her son if a lawsuit promised, even as a threat, to be a possible source of funds. John's position was all too uncertain, even though he had come through his ordeal physically unscathed. The damage to his knee had apparently been largely mental, and was held in respect by Sharon and the police of his own town. His reputation had not been harmed. Perhaps it had been enhanced, though that remained to be seen. It was probably all to the good that the authorities had, so far as he knew, kept his name from the media. He would therefore have time to prepare himself and Joni and the kids for the public attention that would inevitably come in the days ahead. He was suddenly struck by the thought that the story of his day might well have financial value. Would it be sleazy to profit from the misery of others? But did he not deserve compensation for his own travail? This was a matter to be discussed with Joni, whom he would shortly see for the first time since morning, after a moral and emotional eternity. He would, in effect, be coming home from the wars. "Now you take it easy," Officer Cardone told him as John stepped out onto the curbing in front of his home. As Lang had warned him, he saw no nearby vehicle that could be an unmarked police surveillance unit, unless the silver-gray sedan pulled well into his own driveway could constitute such. Now who could own that car? Lang had said a business associate was with Joni, but perhaps it was rather a friend of hers. There were several women who qualified for that role, two of them old school pals who lived in the area, and Joan's cousin's wife was really more than a relative. Any of them might own this car, which looked new. John hoped it was not Renee Wilcox, who quite obviously had always thought little of him. Renee had gone through two divorces before she reached the age of 25,
and her third marriage seemed to be on the rocks within days of the exchange of vows, but ostensibly persisted, if on terms of mutual enmity. She could not be seen as ever being a positive influence, but John never said a word against her. Joan would have been hurt. Standing there before his own door, he felt scarcely less vulnerable than when he had been arrested by the state police. He had no key and would therefore have to ring the bell. He must look a sight. It was more than a mere matter of clothes. Had he worn this attire for a day's worth of chores at home, as he had planned, he would have belonged to an altogether different category of appearance. In his normal world, it was honorable to be besmirched with the stains of honest household functions. Baby food, semi-gloss latex, enamel, machine oil. He especially dreaded being let in by Renee, who might volunteer for the job if Joan was occupied with the children. He disliked Renee, but if he could acknowledge the truth to himself, found her physically desirable, which attraction she probably could detect and exploit while obviously thinking even less of him, he braced himself to meet her sneering amusement. But it was not Renee who opened the door. It was Richie, wearing a warm smile. It was he, all right, though he was dressed in suit and tie and wore glasses.
"We were just wondering when you'd finally show up," Richie said, ushering John inside. "Run into some snags?"
John rushed into the living room. Joan, leaning forward from her seat on the couch, was in the act of pouring coffee from the silver pot, the most valuable of their wedding presents, gift of Uncle Phil's, naturally, into one of the heirloom bone china cups contributed by his mother. The polished silver tray that went with the service held a silver sugar bowl and cream pitcher. Every piece was gleaming, though he knew for a fact that all had been covered with a like coat of black tarnish time out of mind there on the shelf in the cupboard. But a more remarkable transformation had taken place in Joan herself. Her glistening hair was pinned up in the elegant style she ordinarily used only for certain holidays and celebrations. New Year's Eve, for example, for which they went to whichever home Renee, nay Wilcox, was occupying with whatever husband, and the burgundy-colored dress was special as well, along with the pieces of tasteful jewelry, small pearl earrings, the gold brooch from her mother. She was wearing her best shoes, for perhaps only the second time. John believed himself to be out of control, but in fact some sort of inner mechanism must have taken hold of him, for though he wanted to shout the question, he heard it emerge quietly. "Where are the children?"
"Well, thanks for saying hi," Joan reprovingly replied, her dark eyebrows rising, but then she brightened. "Is this what prosperity does to you?"
She lowered the pot.
"The kids are in bed, as they should be at this hour."
She stood up and extended her arms.
"Come here."
She looked past him, smiling, and said,
"I'm sure Mr. Pryor won't mind."
Under the same internal, involuntary management, John went to her and was embraced and kissed.
"Congratulations, kiddo,"
Joan said when she released him, employing the old nickname each had used for the other since seeing, some years earlier, a vintage 1930s film with a heroine who wore limp satin and a chain-smoking hero in wide-brimmed fedora. "Are the children okay?" Joan frowned.
"Yes, they're in bed. Why do you keep asking that?"
"I got to help tuck them in," Richie said behind John's back. John whirled around. Richie wore a simper.
"I envy you, John. One of each, and both a prize. In view of the great news, I'm defrosting the steak we've been saving. I trust it's still edible."
In addition to all else, Joan was wearing a good deal of eye makeup.
"I talked Mr. Pryor into staying for dinner. He's in town alone." "Now, Joan,"
Richie said,
"I'm going to have to leave if you don't stop being so formal with me. We're friends, aren't we? Friends call me Randy."
John could barely move his frozen lips to ask, "What good news?"
"Why, the sale, of course,"
Joni was showing an altogether false animation for the sake of her guest. All was synthetic, from the configuration of her mouth to the angle at which she held her upper body. She smirked at Richie.
It takes John a while.
There was the hint of a glare in her eye when she looked back at her husband.
I'm sure Randy would like a drink. That's your department.
Anything will be just fine, Richie said. Sail was an utterly meaningless word in this context. Richie had become Randy Pryor and was now an intimate of Joan's. He wore a suit and a blue tie and a pair of metal-rimmed eyeglasses. No weapons were in evidence. He had apparently not harmed anybody on the premises, not the children or Joan.
You seem dazed by your success, Joan said
in her new bubbly manner.
Get going, will you please, huh? Things will move fast once the meat is thawed. Randy showed me how to put it under running water. I take it there's some red wine left?
John went to the cabinet under the window that gave onto the side yard. He brought out the 3-liter jug, which was about a quarter full. It sloshed in his trembling grasp. When he glanced up, Joni was gone. Richie smiled at the wine. He had yet to give John a knowing look.
That'll be just well, he said now.
Joan returned immediately. She carried 2 wine glasses. Richie asked solicitously,
You're not joining us? If I had some now, I'd be too woozy to cook the steak. I can't hold much. I'll drink a glass with the meal.
You're slender, Richie said.
That's why it affects you. It takes a heavier person to hold their liquor. I don't want to mention any names, said Joan,
leering toward John and back, and then actually giggling.
Come on, Richie said jovially. Oh, John's not overweight by much, are you, fella? I imagine you're just about right for your build.
John lowered the jug to the coffee table and accepted the glasses from his wife. He filled one and handed it to Richie without raising his eyes.
Okay, Joan said. I'll leave you guys to your business affairs. I calculate the meal will be on the table in 15-20 minutes, if that'll give you enough time. If not, then you'll have to wait till after. It's late enough as is.
John found the persistent lilt in her voice to be unbearable. He did not speak until he heard the noise of the pots and pans from the kitchen. Then he asked dully,
What sale?
Richie had taken an overstuffed chair. He was slumped in it with his legs spread and extended, his shoes resting on the back edges of their heels. They were black leather and so new that the margins of the soles were still light tan.
I'm buying one of your houses. I don't care which one. The one that costs most and is hardest to sell, maybe. Whatever would make you happy, John.
You're going to settle down and live here? Richie grinned.
Why not?
You're going to jail. John was speaking clearly, but at a sufficiently low volume so as not to be heard in the kitchen. He had decided that Joni must not learn the truth about Richie until after he was disposed of conclusively, and of course the children could not be disturbed in any way. Richie's gleeful spirits were not visibly affected. He continued to grin.
No, John, that won't happen.
You killed at least one person today and wounded several more, said John, and added, perhaps naively, How could you do that? Richie lifted his hands in what probably was a kind of shrug. His body movements had changed with the donning of the suit, as his facial expressions had been altered by the glasses.
You've been listening to the cops.
You did those things. Why would they lie? Richie gave him a long, pitying look.
Why would cops lie? Can you be serious?
You were just released from Barnes Psychiatric. Richie swallowed the wine in one gulp.
They gave me a clean bill of health, and I walked out the door.
He passed the empty glass back and forth between his hands.
There's nothing wrong with me, John.
Don't ask me, and don't ask the cops, for God's sake. Ask the doctors, and let's face it, if they don't know, after all the examinations and therapy, who would?
With all respect.
You?
John refilled Richie's glass, but hardly in the automatic execution of his duties as host. He had resumed his old game of playing for time, even though it had been anything but successful when last tried at the farm. He could see no weapons on Richie, but had learned his lesson in that regard at least. The man was always armed with something. Whereas, except for that brief period during which he carried Haverford's shotgun, which he had wrested from the man only for his own protection, John had never, his life long, borne any arms whatever. He returned the wine jug to the coffee table.
I don't claim to understand you in any particular.
Richie smacked his lips loudly after a taste of the second glassful.
It's a manly thing on your part to admit it.
He pointed.
That's why I'm so sold on you. You're a man. You don't carry a gun and club and wear a uniform because you got some kind of doubt about yourself.
Look, John said, I'm willing to consider that you've had problems, a bad childhood or whatever, but...
Come on, John,
Richie said gleefully.
I don't want your pity.
He drank some more wine and assumed a quizzical expression. With his glasses and clothing, he could have passed for someone who worked at a desk in a large office full of people all with the same values.
Yeah, you're right, John admitted. It was false. I don't have any sympathy for you at all. I don't care what troubles you've had. They're not my fault.
Richie laughed.
Good for you. I haven't got any troubles. Certain other people have claimed to have had troubles with me.
Listen, said John, I want you to think about this.
He was still standing by the coffee table.
I'm going to call the police. They've got a car right in this neighborhood. They can get here immediately. Since coming to my house, you appear to have acted like a civilized human being.
John took a breath.
Why not just keep it that way? What you've done can't be undone, but at least don't make it worse. I imagine you'll just get sent back to Barnes.
Richie had begun to shake his head.
No, I can't consider anything of that sort.
What are you going to do then? I'm calling the police.
I'll think of something,
Richie said negligently.
Joan arrived. Excuse us for a minute, Randy, please. Something's come up in the kitchen.
Richie was on his feet.
Can I help? No, please, really, I just need John for a minute, if you can spare him.
In the kitchen, Joanie said,
I don't want to overcook this steak. If I'd known just when you'd be getting home, I'd have started the charcoal outside and you could have taken over from there, but it's too late now.
She shook her head toward the stove.
I've been knocking myself out ever since Randy called, even managed to get the coffee service polished and the kids cleaned up, not to mention myself, even so.
Joanie, John said quietly but with urgency, I want you to call.
You decide,
said she, grinning.
Then I can blame you if the steak is ruined. You can take it. You just made all that money. How much will the commission come to, by the way? Also, which house?
But then she immediately threw up her hands and wailed,
I've got to deal with this steak.
Joan, said John, trying to catch her by the forearm, but she darted to the sink to lift the dripping meat from the colander in which it was being thawed.
Nice. It would be a crime to overcook it.
She replaced the steak and wiped her hands on a kitchen towel.
Where's your barbecue apron? I don't want to ruin this dress. God!
John found his apron in a cabinet drawer and unfolded it for her. It had been her gift to him and was a butcher-striped garment and not the jokey thing sometimes seen. The length was okay for her. Her height was within an inch of his. Melanie, too, was taller than the average girl of her age. It was still too soon to tell about little Phil. John had to protect them. He could not risk having a gun battle on the premises. Richie would not simply surrender to the police.
All right, Joan said now. I'll decide. I just needed the moral support. Better get back to your guest and keep him happy till he writes the check, huh?
She came to John and kissed him.
You did real good, big fella.
Imitating some cowboy movie actor, Joan was gifted as a mimic and had amused him in that fashion over the years. There would be nothing to gain and much to lose by any further attempt to tell her about Richie. The wine's almost gone, he said instead. I'll run down to Sherwood's and pick up a bottle or two. Joan pushed him back, sniffing.
You could use a shower, kiddo, and a shave and a clean shirt and pants. Meanwhile, I'll call Sherwood's and have them deliver. A nice burgundy, you think? What else? Scotch?
While asking these questions, she was pushing him toward the doorway.
I'll put the steak on hold and go keep Randy company. It would help if you could snap it up.
John returned to the living room. Richie was not there. He had gone for the children, but as John rushed toward the nursery, Richie emerged from the guest lavatory at the head of the hall, and they almost collided. John, absurdly, found himself apologizing. Back in the living room, he asked, "What's this Randy Pryor stuff you've handed my wife?"
"It's a name I sometimes use, a professional name like a corporation, you know. All I've been telling Joni is that you and me are doing business, and that's true enough."
"Don't ever call her Joni," John said.
"You're the boss, kiddo."
John bit his lip. He sat down on the couch in exactly the place he found Joan when he got home. She had neglected to take away the coffee pot and cups. He had never seen her so excited. True, had he actually had a commission coming, it would be the first in a long time. But perhaps she had forgotten what he owed Tesmere, which would have to be returned off the top. It was a cruel hoax. John stood up. "Get out of here."
"Pardon?"
Richie was back in the chair, feet out and splayed. "You can't stay," John said. "You're wanted for a long string of terrible crimes. I'm not going to serve you dinner in my house." Richie wore his most charming expression, or what he probably thought was it, his left eyebrow slightly elevated above a twinkling eye.
"It wasn't you who invited me, now was it?"
"I can throw you out, though." Richie bowed. As it were, while remaining seated, he asked with heavy irony,
"Why don't you consult with Mrs. Felton on the matter?"
"Do you think she'd want you here if she knew what you did?" Richie's hands were extended.
"Well, John, let's tell her everything you think you know about me."
He was calling John's bluff. What good could possibly happen if Joni were suddenly told? Her terror would inevitably obstruct anything John might try against Richie. And once the polite, even friendly illusion had been destroyed for her and Richie unmasked, would not she and the children be in greater danger? John sat down again. "Would you be interested in a deal?"
"Then you will sell me a house?"
"I'm serious. What I'm talking about is something like this. You eat dinner, then you leave. I don't lift a hand against you during that time, and I don't notify the police. You eat, then you leave, quietly."
"That's nice."
"You accept?" Richie frowned, speculatively.
"I don't know why I'd object. I don't get many offers, you know. A lot of people are just basically against me. No reason. They take one look and what they see, they hate. It's hard to deal with prejudice like that."
It was too much to have to listen to that sort of thing. John said, "Some more liquor will be here shortly." Richie lifted his glass with its inch of red liquid that he had been nursing since the jug was emptied.
"I hope you didn't order it for me. I'm no drinker."
"You drained that pint of vodka this afternoon like it was water." Richie seemed surprised.
If you say so.
You don't remember?
If I recalled every drink I had, I wouldn't be using my mind for anything else.
John suspected he might be onto something. Do you remember anything you did earlier today?
I hate to disappoint you,
Richie said, returning his glass to the coffee table.
But there's not much worth remembering from day to day in my life. You'd fall asleep if you had to listen to it.
Joan came into the living room. She smiled at Richie. John just has to freshen up for a minute or two. I didn't know selling real estate was heavy labor. I won't be a minute, John told Richie meaningfully, and went rapidly to the bathroom, where he removed his shirt, splashed water in his armpits, and applied deodorant. He hastily stroked chin and cheeks with the electric razor. He went to the bedroom and got a clean shirt. With its tails stuck into the old work pants, the ensemble was incongruous and might annoy Joan. Therefore, he had to take even more time to change trousers and to trade the ancient sneakers for decent leather shoes. It occurred to him that despite the need for haste, he should at least look in on the children whom he was obsessed with protecting, but he heard the doorbell just as he reached the former guest bedroom they called the nursery. He rushed to the front of the house, but Richie already had the door open and was accepting the bag full of clinking bottles from a short young man who John was disappointed to see was not Wally, the elder son of the family that owned the liquor store, but rather someone new. Is Wally sick? The delivery man presented John with a limp bill.
Wally's on vacation.
He rubbed his prominent nose with the back of his hand and looked past the men at Joan, nodding. Seeing an opportunity to get a note to the police in which he could explain the situation and rule out a SWAT team assault, John said, I'll get a pen and sign for it. He was only worried that the new man might be unaware that though state law forbade putting liquor on the tab, Sherwood's did it regularly for folks they knew, even if, like John, they were not frequent customers. But it was Richie who frustrated the effort. He briskly handed John the bag and drew a handful of loose banknotes from his pants pocket.
Let me see the check again,
the delivery man said, rudely snatching it back from John.
There's plenty there,
Richie said, reversing him and literally pushing him out the door.
Keep the extra.
Hey! The guy cried. It seemed the sound of delighted surprise, not complaint. John put the paper bag onto the coffee table. Joan gave him a frown.
You shouldn't let Randy pay. He's our guest.
I wouldn't take no for an answer,
Richie said, rubbing his hands together as though warming them.
You didn't expect to have me for dinner. What's fair is fair.
Joan continued her polite protest, which depressed John. He noisily unpacked the booze so he would not have to listen. The bag yielded a quart of the most expensive bourbon, a bottle of red wine with a French name, and a white from Italy. He had not examined the bill, but it must have been for $50 at least, a good deal more than he would have been prepared to pay, even if the imaginary sale had been made, given their debts.
Then I'll get going, Joan said, springing to her feet.
Listen,
said Richie, waving a mock admonitory finger at her.
I don't want you to go to any trouble now. What's important is friendship, not food.
He seized the bourbon, thumbnailed off the material that sealed the cap, and poured himself a glassful. Judging from the sound, Joni was halfway to the kitchen when she shouted back,
Need eyes?
No thanks. John did not bother to ask their guest.
Joni doesn't happen to have a sister?
Richie asked jovially, in the chair again, leaning back. He drank some whiskey.
John, I want to thank you for taking me in this way. Not many people would have done that.
I didn't take you in, John said. You've got to get out of here. Do you understand? Richie nodded and poured himself more whiskey.
We see eye to eye. And
no, we don't. We're not friends and never were. I'm only putting up with you now because I'm concerned about my wife and children. He realized immediately that he should never have said such a foolish thing. But Richie asked, as if disingenuously,
Is something wrong with them? You might try sharing your problems. That's what friends are for.
John made a strenuous effort to endure. Tell me about yourself. Why do you think you're always in trouble?
My philosophy is, if you think there's something wrong with me, then the burden of proof is on you, not me. Now, there are those who can't take that.
Richie raised his pale eyebrows above the frame of the glasses.
They've got nobody but themselves to blame when things go against them.
I've seen you in action, remember? John had not resumed his seat. You ought to realize that bad things are going to happen when you're out in the world. You're better off in the hospital. You don't belong on the outside. You can't control yourself.
Come on, John. You can't believe that stuff. Else, why would I be a guest in your house right this minute? If I'm so awful, how come Joni insisted I hold the baby? How come your little daughter climbed onto my lap and hugged me and wanted me to be the one who put her in bed? God almighty, John, I never saw a dog that didn't come right to me and put his chin in my hand. At Barnes, they got patients who won't speak a word to anybody but me, guys who look at the wall all day and would wet their pants where they sit rather than leave their place. They do what I say. I tell them to go to the toilet, they do it.
You're allowed to roam around there?
They don't chain you to the wall anymore and whip you,
Richie said, laughing.
Though I've seen some who that might help. They got some real nasty women there with mouths like sewers. I can't stand a bitch who uses foul language.
Is that what happened with the gas station attendant this morning? She swore at you? John wanted to know, while at the same time he found it unbelievable that he was politely questioning a murderer who, as the criminal himself pointed out, was an invited guest. He could not bear to think of Richie's caressing the children, because if he did, he might hate Joni. Which would be wrong, for how could she have possibly known Richie on sight for what he was? He had appeared harmless to John when wearing the t-shirt and cap, in suit, tie and eyeglasses, he looked not only respectable, but the embodiment of all that made sense. The telephone rang. Joni did not like the idea of a phone in the living room, but put up with it because John insisted that he had to be always within no more than 2 rings of an instrument if he were to make certain sales. Strange as it might seem to those with no professional experience, there were people whom the littlest things dissuaded from a course of action, especially when the projected expenditure was in 6 figures. The phone was unobtrusively tucked behind the large ceramic lamp on the table at one end of the sofa, where in truth it proved at least as convenient for Joni's long conversations with relatives and friends as it was for John, who often, when the matter concerned business, would ask the caller to hang on until he could reach the little home office he had set up, again to Joni's complaint in a corner of their bedroom. Perhaps he should have welcomed a call now, but he dreaded it.
John, hi, this is Lang, the detective. How are you doing?
Sure.
Just checking in. Our guy reports all's quiet in the neighborhood. In my opinion, Marinville's a long way from here, in the wind, like we say. He might be demented, but these people usually have a lot of basic judgment. They don't always go where you expect them to when they're fugitives. They can be pretty sly, but it won't last. It won't take him long to do something stupid and get collared, so...
Thanks, said John. He knew he should probably say something that might give Lang a clue, but his mind was too weary now for invention, and the last thing he wanted would be to incite an assault on the house.
Keep your place buttoned up, windows and doors locked if they aren't already. Make you feel safer. But we're not going to forget you. The chief wants you to know he considers this a personal concern of his.
You bet. John put the phone away behind the lamp. He had not looked toward Richie during his conversation with Lang, but he had a feeling that the man had not been much interested in it. that he could have said anything without putting himself in jeopardy. Nevertheless, he explained.
Business.
Ritchie nodded and drank from his glass.
Which hasn't been good lately.
My wife told you that? John was furious.
You told me this afternoon,
said Ritchie. He looked benign.
What Joni said was how terrific you are.
John stared at him.
We all think a lot of you, man. You got a lot of support. You're a winner.
To hell with you. Ritchie was wounded.
What brought that on?
Just remember, we got a deal. You eat dinner and then you leave. John felt a great need to look in on the children whom he had not seen since morning. This represented more concern for himself than for them. They were sleeping through it all, and if he could pull it off, would stay ignorant until they were adults, whereas he could use an exposure to their innocence. But Joan came in at that moment.
All right, gentlemen, dinner is served.
She exchanged beaming expressions with Ritchie and led them to the dining room, where the table was set with the Feltons' best china, the plates rimmed in gold, and the reserved for guests linen tablecloth and napkins.
While you're having your soup, I'll be doing the steak, if you'll excuse me.
Joan addressed these remarks to the guest.
It's the only way I know to make sure it won't get overdone.
Ritchie was standing at a diffident distance.
Please.
Joan indicated a chair.
Right in the middle,
Ritchie said, extending a hand toward each of the extremities of the table.
You're spoiling me rotten.
Wait till you've tasted the food. You might change your tune. Please, sit down and begin.
You're not having soup?
Now don't you worry about me.
John felt like the outsider. As such, he took his seat while the guest was still standing. The soup steamed before him in its bowl. It was recognizably the canned chicken noodle favored by Melanie, whom he had shown how noisily to suck up the strands of pasta while crossing one's eyes. This had not won applause from her mother. Joan appeared in the kitchen doorway.
The wine, John, the wine.
So he had to get up and go fetch the bottles from the living room and find the corkscrew under the clutter in the drawer of the sideboard. By the time he had opened the bottle of red wine, Joni was back with a filled salad bowl.
We're starting with white,
she reproachfully told him.
My fault,
Ritchie said with a little contrite shrug.
I was drinking red earlier. I don't know anything about wine.
John looked bleakly at the two of them, the stars of this grotesquerie, then dutifully opened the white wine and poured a glassful for Ritchie. Joan went to the kitchen. Ritchie began to drink soup from a dainty spoon. John had eaten nothing since breakfast cereal, but he certainly had no appetite now. In the suit and tie, and especially the glasses, Ritchie looked genteel enough, and his features might even be called patrician, insofar as John understood the term, which would seem to apply principally to the nose, longish but narrow and poreless, and eyes on the small side. Where had he gone to shave and acquire the clothing? And what of the automobile parked outside?
I'm sure you stole the car,
John said in a voice designed not to penetrate the kitchen doorway, beyond which Joan anyway was making a clatter.
You robbed somebody, took his car and his money, and bought the clothes, maybe. Or stole them, too. But the glasses, I can't figure them out. I like the way they feel.
Ritchie jiggled them with a hand to either temple piece. I just wish I could see better through them. Driving here wasn't easy.